So we're going back to the Gospel of John. We've been working through this for about a year and a half, and we paused for the summer, and now we're going to try to charge through it again for a while and maybe finish sometime in the spring. I don't know about you, but the combination of kids going back to school and it's getting a little cooler at night and the sunsets are gorgeous and all those things, it feels like there's hints of fall, right? Like not full-on sweaters yet, but at least hints and whispers of fall is coming. And so for me, when I get to that season, because I am who I am, I start thinking about comfort foods, right? Like I start thinking about the things I want to eat in the fall. And like s'mores are high on that list. But one of the ones that's probably odd for me, that isn't for you, is mole. Now, how many of you have had mole? Bam! Oh, yeah. Well, you lived in Mexico too, right? So, lost control. So, a typical mole can take as many as 30 ingredients. It's like the sauce from Mexico. It's the best part of Mexican cuisine. So if I had to choose a cuisine of the world, we all owe the French most of what we eat. But if I had to pick a cuisine for the rest of my life, Mexican for sure. And mole is the top of the list. So yesterday, I had an ingredient list very similar to most of that, I think. Not pumpkin seeds. I used sesame seeds. And I didn't put the peanuts. That's interesting. So anyway, but mine was pretty close to that many ingredients. And so Gavin and I made a mole yesterday, and then we let it simmer all night. And then I came in late last night, and it had been simmering, and it was really thick and velvety, and I got to taste it. And if you've ever tasted a good mole, it's like a combination of sweet and spicy, and there's just so many great spices, anise and cinnamon. And what else? Ground pepper. I put it all in my pestle, mortar and pestle, and like ground all the spices. And okay, nobody else is into this like I am. You guys are. Maybe you should come over for mole sometime. So, because I just think when it turns to fall, there ought to be mole in the freezer at all times that I can just pull out mole and warm it up and then chicken and rice and let's stop. All right, so the reason I'm talking about mole is not because I'm digressing like I'm prone to do, but rather because I think sometimes when we come to a passage of Scripture, we think it's one thing, but then once we get into it, it becomes like mole. There's all these hints and notes and things and this thing and that thing, and oh, I never thought about that. And when I had thought about this passage, we're in John 11, when I had thought about this passage for most of my life, this passage, when people would say, like, what's this one about? It's about the raising of Lazarus. We're going to read it in just a second. It's about the raising of Lazarus. People would often say, I think the message I got for most of my life was this passage is about how Jesus has power over death. Done. That's the end of it. That is about 5 or 6 verses in this passage of 57 verses. About 5 verses of this chapter are about Jesus actually raising Lazarus. And there's 50 other verses about other things going on. And I just pause, digression. This is what I love about studying the Bible, right? Is that it feels like sometimes people just trying to mellow it out and give you like, you know, brown gravy when it's mole. For those of you that have had mole, is that a good analogy? Brown gravy, mole. And those of you that hadn't, I'm sorry that I just gave you all this. I really thought about bringing in a big pot of mole and letting everybody stick their fingers in and try it. Communion! Next week is communion, tortilla chips and mole. All right. So what we're going to do this morning is, I'm not going to read this passage all in one shot. It's 57 verses. We're going to work through it in 6 sections. So basically, the way this passage comes to us, the way John delivers this story to us, is in the series of 6 meetings that are had. There's a meeting with Jesus and the people that come to tell him what's going on. There's a meeting among the disciples as they talk. There's a meeting with Martha. There's a meeting with Mary. There's a meeting with Lazarus. And then the Jewish Sanhedrin meets. And so we're going to tackle the passage in those 6 meetings and ask ourselves, why is John telling us this part of the story? What's happening here? And work through the passage. And so I hope, if you're like me, as I was studying this week, like there's just all kinds of great tidbits and great pieces and great like, oh, that's so good. And it's not just about Jesus having power over death, which is a big thing, and later on, I'll tell you a foreshadowing. That's the section I have the least to say about. So we might hurry through that part, but there's just so many like good little pieces, and I'm wasting time. So let's go. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. John 11. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. By the way, his name, El Azar, means God has helped. Now, a man named God has helped was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. Which, just so you know, is funny because that story doesn't appear until the next chapter. So John knows his audience already knows these stories, but he's a little bit foreshadowing here. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." When he heard this, Jesus said, "The sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. Then he said to the disciples, He stayed where he was 2 more days. So if you're new with us, what we do right here is I pause and I shut up and I take a drink and you tell me, what seems significant or of value or interesting or quirky or what stood out to you in this part of the passage? Staying 2 more days, why? Yeah. Yeah, she didn't know he was going to... Okay, yeah, so put ourselves in the passage, in the timeline. She doesn't know that he's going to come. All she knows is that he heard and then did what? Nothing. Jesus heard the request and went, okay. And from her perspective. And it's funny because sometimes when we're reading the Bible, we know how the story ends. So we read back into it what we already know. And we're like, well, of course, Jesus was in control. But if you're Mary and Martha and you just sent word to Jesus about, hey, this person that you love died. And he went, boy, that feels hard. We're going to talk about that in just a second. What else? Oh, so putting ourselves in the shoes of Jesus, how hard it was to sit knowing that your friend is suffering and that your friends around him are suffering as well as they watch him die. Good. Yeah. Oh, isn't that great? Yeah, he loved them. That was the reason that compelled him to not do anything. Think about that for just a minute, right? And I think because of what we'll find out eventually, like he knows what he's going to do. Wow, good. Yeah, in a culture that dismisses women, women are often the central figures in Jesus' stories. And here again, like it shows this deep relationship. A couple things I'll point out and then we'll keep moving is I didn't put a slide for this one, but I love this idea about now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Now, of course, who does Jesus love? All of us, right? But there is this hint. This is the humanity of Jesus that we see on display. Oftentimes we think of Jesus kind of floating along earth. This is the place where Jesus' feet are firmly in the dirt and there are people that he's close to. And the text is telling us like these are some of those people that yes, Jesus loves everybody the same, but there's this space that he has for them. And we're going to see it later on in John 11, how he's moved with compassion for them. The two things that grab me in this, and one is just a really quick observation, is that intercession here is only informing. I was in a church context at one point in my life where there was a lot of emphasis put on the right technique for prayer, that we need to learn how to pray a certain way and to ask a certain thing. And I've been in places in where people were praying and praying very specific, like, God, you heal this, you do this, God, do this, we want you to do that. And that's fine. I'm not putting down those traditions. But I know for me, I've always felt wildly uncomfortable in those settings. It's just not me. And so I've always felt a little bit like strange, even in a hospital setting. And when I'm praying for somebody, like what do I pray here? Like I want to pray whatever Jesus is actually going to do and not give this person false hope or declare things for Jesus that Jesus isn't intending to do, right? And I love the freedom here that what does the intercession look like? It just looks like a statement. Jesus, Lazarus is sick. She didn't send word and ask him to do anything. She just trusts that him knowing is enough. Now think about that just like for a minute. Think about in a relationship, like let's say with that closest person, your spouse, and all they have to do is know that it's enough. You ever had that experience? Like come home from work and Jennifer knows it's been a hard day and I get home and she's, you know, like just like, I know today was hard. Things are taken care of. And just that she knew, and I didn't need to ask. I didn't need to say, hey, I need the night off. I need whatever. She just knew. She knows what I need because she knows me and I don't have to ask. And I think for me, that gives me a lot of freedom in intercession. When I bring my request before God, I don't have to think about what God might want to do or not want to do. All I need to do is just say them. Like this is what I'm concerned about. This is what's in me. This is what I want you to notice. And I've told people in some other contexts, my prayer life these days when it comes to intercession, and this may sound dumb to some of you, and archaic to anybody under 30, we used to have these things called photo albums. And in a photo album, you printed all your pictures, and then you put them in sleeves so you could look at them later. Some of you under 30 have no idea. What? Oh, yeah, thank you. Yes, you went to Walgreens and you took in your roll and handed them your roll of film, and then you got pictures back, and then you threw half of them away. And so these days, I think of my intercessions kind of like this, right? Like, I picture myself flipping through an album with God, and like, there's my wife, and I care about her. There's my children. There's this thing. There's this person. It's for me, what's freeing to me is to simply inform and trust that Jesus will act in the way that Jesus will act. The second thing in these first six verses for me that's really interesting is this idea that you guys jumped on right away, because Jesus hears and he loves and he does nothing. I think that part of the experience of a maturing faith, some days, I think for many of us, the faith journey starts at places where we feel like answers to prayer abound, that God is present to us like all the time, and that part of the journey of faith and part of maturing as a faith is the growing silence of God. That many saints report that it seems like the further we go in the journey, the more it feels like we are confident that Jesus hears us. I am confident that Jesus loves me. And I'm confident that I just don't hear much a lot of the time. But what a maturing faith looks like, an immature faith, we get to the spot of Jesus does nothing, and so then we begin to believe that he doesn't love us or he doesn't hear us. And the journey of a maturing faith is to get to that place of understanding that Jesus does nothing, but he still loves and he still hears. And I know for many of you in this room, that's a tough journey right there, right? Is waiting for Jesus to do something, and maybe you've been asking and asking and interceding and asking and asking and begging and pleading, and yet there's this silence that nothing seems to be happening. And waiting for, is God going to do anything here? I was going to jump ahead to the response of Didymus. Let's keep reading, because the response to that is great. Then he said to his disciples, verse 7, "Let us go back to Judea." "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago the Jews there had tried to stone you, and yet you are going back." Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in the daytime will not stumble, for they see by this world's light. It is when a person walks at night that they stumble, for they have no light." Jesus is just saying right here, like, I'm just going to live my life in the light. I'm just going to live it, and what happens, happens. After he said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going to wake him up." His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get better." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but the disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead, and for your sake, I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let's go to him." Then Thomas, also known as Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." Echo back, like, what do you hear? What's fun? Let's start right there. How do you hear Thomas saying that? I took an interpretive choice. How do you hear it? Smart Alec, yes. That's what I hear. Cynical? A little jaded. What else? That he would go die with Lazarus? Perhaps. I mean, Lazarus is dead. Maybe the assumption there is we're all going to be in the grave with Lazarus before the day's out. Yeah. Yeah. I love the he's asleep, and their response is like, good, sleep is what you need when you're sick. Just like, yeah, how do I say this a different way? He's dead. Yeah. This is such fun in this passage, yeah. I think that's exactly what Thomas is referring to. It's like, if we're going back, you're going to get stoned and we're all going down with this ship, yeah. Anybody else? A couple more. Right. You know, I don't think I'd put that together, that what they're asking him to do is come back to an area. It tells us Bethany is 2 miles from Jerusalem and his greatest opposition's in Jerusalem. So they're asking him to come back to the place where there's the greatest opposition, the greatest possibility that he'll be killed. So they're not just saying, like, come do something, Jesus. They know what they're asking of him, and it's a big ask. That's good. Thank you. Yeah. So I love Didymus. I love him in this passage. Where's the other place we see Didymus in Scripture? You remember? after the resurrection, and he's the one that says what? Show me his hands. Like, I want to stick my fingers in the holes in Jesus, right? Which is awesome there too, right? So Didymus, Thomas, seems to be this person who's deeply cynical about faith claims made by other people. I was going to ask for a show of hands. Anybody else? Right? I love him. What I love most about him, though, is that his response in the midst of his cynicism is what? Faith. I'll follow. I'm deeply cynical about what you're doing here. You're going to take us to a place that's going to get killed, and I'm totally going to be a smart aleck about it. But when you start down the road, guess who's going to be right behind you? I'll be there. I love, love, love that. I don't know if you all know this about me, but I have a little bit of cynicism that lies inside of me. It's come out on occasion, right? I have big doubts about faith some days. And I love this picture of Didymus just still following. Bruce. Sure. Yeah, whatever. And it, yeah, so maybe he's not, Bruce is saying, maybe he's not cynical. Maybe he's just determined. I still admire that, you know? I think the reason I read cynical into it is because of the Acts passage. Because the other picture we have of him is like, I don't believe it until I see it myself. And so I want to reflect on him for just a minute. Because I think that there's a lot of us in this room. I think part of our, you know, church vibe is that, you know, we're doubters and cynics. I mean, that's at least our reputation. If that scares you, I'm sorry. But there's also, I think, this determination as I interact with many of you that we're a determined lot, right? That we keep following and we keep like, I don't know that I understand it that way. I'm not sure. But let's go. And if it leads to death, it leads to death. It made me think about my one of my very favorite books. I'm 16 years into ministry, and if you would have met me in the first half of my ministry, this was probably at the very top of my list of my favorite books, called Reaching for the Invisible God by Philip Yancey. He was so important to me back in the early days of my ministry that our third son's middle name is Philip, named for him with one L. And so... It was a really big deal to me. And this book, I've probably never done a book in small groups as much as I've done this book. I swear I've led like 5 or 6 small groups through this book because I like it so much and it holds up. And this particular copy, I don't know if I've shared this all with you before. When my pastor died a few years ago and I went and spoke at his funeral, after the funeral, his wife let me and my friend Tyler into his office and we got to take the books that we wanted. And so this is his copy. And so you can't borrow it is the net result of this, because it's got all of the things he underlined, and he underlined like most of every page and starred things and wrote comments, and it's just a really precious book to me. So I was looking it up, because the premise of the book is this, is that when we talk about a relationship with God, I know what regular relationships look like. I can look you in the eye and I can read your body language and I can hear the words you say. I notice the things you don't say, all the things that we do in relationships, right? And then people tell me that having a relationship with God is like that. And that has never worked for me, right? Because when I talk to God, God doesn't always talk back, and I can't read his body language, and I can't, like, I have some of the things he said, but I think he says more things, and then sometimes it feels like he's just really silent, which as a talker is really hard for me in any relationship, and then it's just really hard. And so Yancey acknowledges that thing and says, hey, having a relationship with an invisible deity is not the same thing as having a human relationship, and it's really hard sometimes. And so he works through that in this book, and it's brilliant and beautiful. And so it's some of this stuff we're talking about Didymus. So I want to show you two things that caught my attention this week as I was flipping through this book again, because this Didymus thing got me going on. The first one is a quote from C.S. Lewis where he talks about this journey of following, even though we maybe feel doubtful and cynical. And he says this: avoid silence, avoid solitude, avoid any train of thought that leads off the beaten path. Concentrate on money, sex, status, health, and above all on your own grievances. Keep the radio on. Live in a crowd. Use plenty of sedation. If you must read books, select them very carefully, but you're safer to stick to the papers. You'll find the advertisements helpful, especially those with a sexy or snobbish appeal. What Lewis is saying is that these are all the ways to not be on the path of Didymus. And they are the ways that our culture lives all the time, right? Many of us find ourselves slipping into this kind of space. I find in my own life when I'm not reading well, and I'm a reader and I try to keep my disciplines of reading alive, I start slipping into this space where I'm reading the papers, right? I'm reading the news and all that stuff, and then I get all kinds of bitter and angry, and it's not a good place for me. There's another quote from Lewis here, and I need to set it up before you flip there. It comes from the Screwtape Letters. So for those of you, I realize that we're getting pretty far away from Lewis, so let me explain how the Screwtape Letters work. Lewis writes this book called the Screwtape Letters, and the idea of the whole book is that it's a senior demon writing to a young demon on how to tempt humans well. And so it's a series of letters that Screwtape writes to his nephew Wormwood and is telling him how to tempt people well. So you have to, as you're reading, think opposite, right? Does that help? All right, maybe, maybe not. Go to the quote. He says this: "It is during such trial periods, like the Didymus doubt thing, much more than during the peak periods, that it," and by the "it" here, he's referring to the human being, "it is growing into the creature he wants it to be." So it's in those doubt periods, it's in those cynical moments that we're growing into the creature he wants us to be. Hence, the prayers offered in the state of dryness are those that please him best. He wants them to learn to walk and must therefore take away his hand. And if only the will to walk is really there, he is pleased even with their stumbles. Do not be deceived, Wormwood. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring, but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks round a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished and asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys. That is what he's saying here about Didymus, right? We look around the world and we see the absence of God and ask, why have I been forsaken by God and still choose to follow? If we go die, we go die. And what Lewis says is that's what pleases God. That's the growth of maturity as he takes his hand away from the believer and says, now you must learn to walk. Will you follow me even when you're cynical and even when you're doubtful and even when it's hard and even when it's in a trial period? Will you continue to follow? Verse 17. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Let me just real quick say, Jewish rabbinical thought around this time was that the soul kind of lingered around the body for 3 days, and then after 3 days was like, I guess we're really dead, and took off. So the idea of this verse is just to say, really dead, okay? So Jesus shows up, he's been in the ground 4 days, read it as he's really dead, not mostly dead. Now Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, I said that earlier, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. And Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. And Martha answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day, which was a common Pharisee thought. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this? Yes, Lord, she replied. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who has come into the world. Thoughts, reflections, ideas. Yeah. Well, he wasn't in Jerusalem at this time. He's further away. He comes down, I believe when they start the passage, is he in Jerusalem? He's in, Lazarus was in Bethany, which was 2 miles from Jerusalem. Jesus is still in Galilee when we start this story. Does that make sense? I'm pretty sure, because when we ended this a couple months ago, I told you all that was the end of the great Galilean ministry. So that might help your timeline. Yeah. The timing is a little weird. And that's where sometimes when the gospel writers are writing, they're setting up a story and the details to us are a little fuzzy. Because again, we don't know exactly where Jesus was. We don't know that the envoy that went out, when they left, when they left, what did they know? Had Lazarus already died? Or maybe he died while they were en route and Jesus chooses not to tell them? Well, that's what he says, yeah, is that part of this delay is so that you will believe. And they don't get that in the moment. They're going to get that later, why he says that. But part of his delay we see later in the passage is like, oh, we see why he's delaying because he's going to do this thing. Yeah, and that's one of those places, too, where when we read back into it, we're like, these stupid people. And they're not. Like, they're just dealing, like, yeah. I mean, I think what she's expressing here is really amazing. Like, yeah, I'm a little bummed that you didn't get here earlier, but Lazarus is going to rise again. We'll see him. It's okay. She is pretty, like, even-keeled with Jesus in this. And but the part I like the most is he gives her this statement that's huge. I am the resurrection and the life, and the one who believes in me will live even though they die. Whoever lives by believing me will never die. Do you believe this? That's a huge statement. And she doesn't say, like, yeah, I believe all those things. What does she say? I believe you. Yeah. Wow. That jumps in, right? The men get it wrong, and it's the way she's right. Yeah. But she's still missing the big piece because she doesn't know that yet. Yeah. Oh, that's rich, Mary. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good word. Okay, so little Enneagram factoid for you all. In the Enneagram, type 6 is the fearful person. I was listening to a podcast this week that says about half the people that take the Enneagram turn out to be a 6. That our culture is super fearful. So then you watch the Today Show and it's like, be afraid of your refrigerator. Oh no, like, gotta watch after the commercial. And marketers aren't dumb. They know that people are afraid and they're appealing to danger, fear all the time. Listen to the politicians. They're doing the same thing. And there's fear here all over. If we don't read fear in this passage, there's a very real possibility that when we go back to Jerusalem, we're dead men. And Jesus does nothing to alleviate their fear. And in fact, in a couple minutes, is going to heighten it. He's going to ramp it up. When he resurrects Lazarus, he's going to ramp up that fear, the danger scenario. But he walks with them in it. And that's a huge maybe spiritual insight for some of us, is that Jesus isn't in the business usually of taking our fears away, but rather walking with us in the fears. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Yeah. Yeah, Mary just said there's the other scripture, I think it's Isaiah maybe, is where he says, I will visit their fears upon them. That you're going to have to go through these things. There's no way to grow except to go through these things. It's the quote I used a couple weeks ago from The Walking Dead about good calm seas don't make good sailors. It's that idea. You have to go through the rough things to get there. Sure, sure. I know what's happening here. Martha does a little bit of that. I would like to see Martha as super even keeled here. I just think that, and I'll give you the foil here in just a second when we read the next section. I want to point out what I love about her is this thing, and it's similar to Thomas at this point too, is when she says, he says, do you believe all of this? And he gives her all these like deep theological things. I am the resurrection. I'm the life. Those that believe in me will not die. Like huge theology here, right? And she responds at a much more personal level. And I picture her like being a little confused, like, well, I don't know exactly what you're talking about, but I believe you. I'll follow you. And I think that's a huge thing for those of us in our journeys. And I know that's a huge thing for a lot of us in this room, that there's a lot of pressure sometimes in some context that we have all our theologies right. Why do you make sure you know what you believe so that you can tell people what you believe? And sometimes I'm not sure what I believe. But I believe Jesus. And I'm following Jesus. And it seems to be in this moment, all through this Gospels, that that's enough. That following is enough of an answer to that. Like, I don't know all the theology of what's going to happen to my brother, but I believe you. I need to confess something. Over the last 4 months, in almost every sermon, I've worked in a surreptitious Hamilton quote. And those of you that know Hamilton have been laughing as I do this. Not hiding it this week. There's this line in Hamilton there's a song called That Would Be Enough, and it's his wife singing to him. And I love this idea. I don't pretend to know the challenges you're facing, the worlds you keep erasing and creating in your mind, but I'm not afraid. I know who I married. So as long as you come home at the end of the day, that would be enough. And I love this because I think about this is what marriage is, right? Like I have no idea walking out the doors today what's going to happen in my life. We have no idea about where our road leads us. And if we just look back, we'd be like, I got here. And who couldn't have guessed that I'd end up here? We have no idea. But that part of marriage and what marriage is trusting in the person you're married. And we're in it. And we're going to figure it out together. Whatever life brings at us, we're going to do this thing together. And I think that's the spirit of Martha here. Is I may not understand all this big stuff that you're saying about my brother and resurrection and life and all that stuff. But I believe you, and I'm following you. Which leads us then to the response of her sister. After she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here, she said, and asking for you. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. And when the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. The exact same words Martha says, by the way. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. Jesus wept. My favorite verse when I was a kid at Bible school. Give me a gold star. Then the Jews said, see how he loved him. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Which is a great setup to what's about to happen, right? Loser. What strikes you about the Mary story here? This Mary meeting with Jesus, what strikes you? Okay, yeah, let's go from here. What do we know about these two sisters from Luke? Luke 10, what do we know from about these two sisters? Do you remember the story? What's that? Why aren't you helping me? Which sister is the hero of the previous story? It's Mary who's sitting at the feet of Jesus and Martha is so busy in the kitchen preparing the food. And so I've heard so many sermons in my life about be a Mary, not a Martha. And I'm so Martha by nature. That's who I am, right? And so it's always like feels a little bit like, oh, come on. And I love that it gets turned around that in this story, Martha is the one that's level-headed and Mary is so depressed and so worked up about this that she can't even go out to meet Jesus initially with Martha. She stays at home. A couple thoughts real quick. First of all, that first line there right at the beginning, what does Martha say to her? What does Martha say to her? He's asking for you. Is that true? From what we have in the text, did Jesus ask for her? We call that movement grace. We call that movement where Mary is sitting at home. And we're reading a little bit to the text, but assuming that Mary is sitting there because she's so broken and so sad. And the only thing she does in this passage is she asks the same question Martha does and then breaks down crying. Martha said the same words and then said, but I'll see him again someday. I'm following you. Mary says the exact same words to Jesus and then puddle of tears. Martha's the hero of this story. Mary's the one. And so there's this great back and forth. I loved this in the commentary I was reading, and I hate quoting commentaries, but it was just too good. He says, in both Luke and John, Mary is at Jesus' feet, symbolizing her devotion. So she says that is at his feet. But devotional and depressed spirits are often the front and back sides of the same persons. Sensitivity can be a strength or a weakness depending on the situation. I know there's some of us in this room that know that, right? It's those of us that are the most sensitive that get to have those Mary moments, and those of us that are most sensitive that find ourselves in really dark places sometimes. Lucky for the rest of you all, right? Like there's this thing where Martha's pretty steady, right? She's working for Jesus. She gets to Jesus. There's a steadiness to Martha that we see in this passage. And that Mary, who's so sensitive to Jesus the first time, is the one that's really struggling through this thing. And I love the grace of Martha to her sister here. And then the grace of Jesus. What is Jesus' response? That she accuses him and then puddle of tears at his feet. And I know it's the shortest verse in the Bible, but it's so lovely, right? That Jesus then joins her in the weeping. There's a lot of great conjecture and story and conversation about why Jesus cries here. Maybe he cries just because it tells us that he loves Mary and Martha and Lazarus. They're special to him. Maybe he cries because all the Jews were crying there. That's what sitting Shiva looks like. Or maybe I tend to think that he's crying here because this is a first row seat to the hard part of what it means to be human. The tragic outcome of the fall is death, and Jesus is front row at the pain that death causes. And if you don't know that pain, it's just because it hasn't hit that close to you, but it will. And the deep sense of loss, and that Jesus is sitting right in this moment in the very epicenter of the brokenness of humanity, that we all die. And I believe that his movement here is that it breaks him, and that's his tears here. We're about out of time, so let me finish quickly. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb, and it was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. Take away the stone, he said. But Lord, said Martha, the sister of the dead man, by this time, it stinks. He's been in there 4 days. Again, love her practicality. Then Jesus said, did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? And I read that personally not as a rebuke, but as a reassurance. Like, don't worry, Martha. Haven't I told you, when you believe, you will see the glory of God. So they took away the stone, and Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And then this line, the intimacy of him with God. I know that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here so that they may believe that you sent me. When Jesus said this, he called out in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. And if you grew up at a certain age in a certain way, you heard Carmen sing this, and that's all you can hear in your head. The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. And Jesus said to them, take off the grave clothes and let him go. So I'm going to just keep moving. This is the part of the story we're most familiar with. Jesus is victorious over death. It's the first time that we've recorded that he does this. And this becomes a foreshadowing of what's going to happen to him. Like, right? Like, this is the like, oh, this is going somewhere in the story. Therefore, let's finish this out. Many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin, which is the highest council. What are we accomplishing? Here is a man performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe him. Then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Just this, we can talk about this if you want to talk to me offline, but this is a ridiculous thing. Like, what they're more fearful of is that Jesus is going to take away their followers. And so they're making a false situation over here as a smoke screen. Like, oh no, we got to be worried about this, when really the thing they're mostly worried about is their own seats. Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. Dun, 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 right? Like, that statement right there, obviously John is writing that years later, and we're supposed to hear that statement of Caiaphas and be like, oh yeah, that Caiaphas, he doesn't know how right he is. He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. John just says it so well, writing much later than the event. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the people of Judea. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the wilderness, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. And when it was time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus as they stood in the temple courts and asked one another, what do you think? Is he coming to festival at all? But the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that anyone who found out where Jesus was should report it so they might arrest him. The irony of this meeting is that what they conclude is that the man who brings people back to life is the one who should be killed. And it's one of those pieces, as we're thinking about the mole, right? Like, it's one of those pieces that this passage is about so many things at once. There's a flavor of this and a hint of that. And so it's about Jesus and resurrection power. It's about the sisters and how they respond to him. It's about the disciples and the conversation they have. It's about the religious leaders and how they're plotting to put him to death and the drama from a political standpoint. It's hints and pieces of all these things. And so we're going to end with something. There's a way of reading the scriptures. It comes to us from the Ignatian stream. And it's called Ignatian contemplation. And the idea of this idea is it's called imaginative prayer. And the exercise is this. It's from the Ignatians that we get where we study scripture in Lectio Divina. Like, that's where it comes from. And so what the Ignatians ask us to do is they ask us to sit with a passage like this, and they ask us to put ourselves into the passage. And to do it really well, you give yourself lots of time and space where we would actually sit, and I would ask you questions like, what does it smell like? What does it feel like? What do you feel? But the point of the passage is to ask you this question. Who? Who is it in this story that you connect with? As I've been talking the last 40 minutes, which character, which conversation did you just go, oh, that's my person? Because there probably was one. And so here's six of the characters. Didymus, cynical but still following. Martha, disappointed but willing. Mary, trapped in despair. Lazarus, raised from the dead. We could have said a lot more there, right? About what it means to be raised from the dead. And some of us have been in spaces in our life where we've been metaphorically dead in some way, and we need a resurrection. Caiaphas, still defiant. Or Jesus, faithful. And I love the discipline of Jesus in this story. Like, I would love to run to my brother's aid, but I'm going to wait. I'm going to work this journey out. So what I want to do is, here at the end of the story, I want to shut up for a minute, all right? And I want you just to sit with this story. And I'm only going to give you about a minute, but I want you to imagine yourself into the story, and I want you to imagine yourself as one of those characters and how you want to respond to Jesus. And there's no right or wrong answer here. I just want to invite you in this space, in this very brief moment, to respond to Jesus as that character. Maybe some of you are like, boy, I'm Thomas, and I want to be what Thomas was, and I need to say that to Jesus. Or maybe some of you are just, you know what, I'm in a Mary space, and I'm just trapped in despair, and I'm a puddle of tears, and I just want to weep at the feet of Jesus. Whatever it is that you want to say out of that space to Jesus, we're just going to be quiet, and then I'll wrap us up all with prayer, okay? So let's close our eyes and just be quiet for a minute and put yourself back in the story we just read. First of all, Father, thank you for these great, rich, rich stories in the scriptures. Thank you for the complexity and all the pieces and the ways it hits, I'm sure, each of us in a little different way, and how we're inspired and our thoughts are provoked, and there's just so many like hints and pieces here. And I'm thankful for church being a mole type place where there's just all kinds of people in different spaces and different reactions and different thoughts, even as we've heard this morning, that some of us hear it one way and some of us hear it another way. And yet you're calling all of us to follow. And so God, some of us this morning here, sit here, and we are Thomas, and some of us are Mary, and some of us are Martha, and some of us are Jesus and Caiaphas and Lazarus. And we each come with our thing and we bring it to you. And Jesus, I pray that just to make you aware of us. And we know that you love us, and we know that you hear us, and we want you to act on our behalf. And we also recognize that sometimes that means waiting in silence. And so help us in that tension. Help us to have the people around us that keep walking with us in that, that keep challenging us in that. Thank you that you have the power to resurrect Lazarus, and you have the power to move any of us from whatever seat we sit in, whatever character we identify with, to bring us to new places of following after you. In your name I pray. Amen.